Well, as the pastor said, we the session we're asked to address this topic of a Christian view of entertainment, or I have it along the lines of entertainment, a biblical worldview. It's a really broad topic. Of course, we could answer it very quickly and just say the Bible doesn't approve of entertainment. So, okay, that was just a joke. I'm done here. Okay, well, to fit this into a weekend, I think we have to really cover some, you know, some things, or not cover some things, only cover other things. So we're going to cover really, for entertainment, we're really mainly going to cover what we might consider cultural forms of entertainment. The arts, literature, movies, and music, right? So I was thinking about this. We're leaving aside a lot of other things, like other kinds of entertainment, games, team sports. You know, Mr. Yost could spend probably a whole weekend Bible study just on teams from Denver, Colorado. Or hockey. Stamp collecting, you know, other forms of entertainment like picking on your sister, or hanging out, shopping, even such very sanctified forms of entertainment as fly fishing and pheasant hunting. And we're going to leave those out. But even covering the things we have left will be somewhat difficult. And some of what we discuss will be applicable to other forms of entertainment. But there's a good reason for covering what we might call cultural forms of entertainment. It's just that they are just that, they're cultural. Right? So culture is sometimes said to be religion externalized. This could be a study in and of itself, which we won't have time for. I'll just keep telling you all the things we won't have time for, and then finally, after that, we'll have time for something. But you could think of culture as being a reflection of the moral and spiritual consensus of our age, of our society. It's a reflection of the beliefs of our society as a whole. We could think of it metaphorically as the river that we swim in, right? And sort of morally and spiritually speaking. So we can swim against the current or we can swim with the current. We can stop swimming, but then we're either going to drown or just go with the flow. So in thinking about how to organize these talks, besides the issue of splitting up the arts, literature, movies, and music, we thought another important thing to cover was the the overall approach. Okay, so specifically, as is sometimes said, there are two sides of the road to fall off of, or maybe two ditches that you can fall into with respect to entertainment. If we borrowed some labels from Brian Godawa, he's author of a book called Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Films with Wisdom and Discernment, and that book is sitting right here. And in fact, the books that I'm going to refer to are sitting right here. And if you'd like to take a look at them afterwards, that would be fine. I want to take them away with me, but you'd be welcome to take a look at them. So, well, he called the two ditches. I don't think he used the term ditches, but he called them cultural anorexia and cultural gluttony. Okay, so I imagine since you're teenagers, you're all aware of anorexia. Since you're, I think at least most of you are from the RP Church, I'm sure you've heard the term gluttony before. Cultural anorexia is the idea that Christians, for example, just shouldn't watch movies or read books other than, you know, the Bible and maybe some books on theology and history and so on. But just books for entertainment would be a bad idea. And it could certainly be applied in, you know, more than one level. But in general, the idea would be this: to say that books, arts, movies—that's all sort of worldly thing to do, and we don't want to be worldly, right? We just want to focus on Christ. By cultural gluttony, we might mean that, for example, we could consume, much like eating, we could consume too much of culture. Okay, now that could mean several things. It could mean that we consume too much of meat, potatoes, vegetables, and fruit—things that are all good for us—but we consume too much of them. Or it could mean we eat too much dessert, stuff that's okay maybe in moderation, right? But if you eat dessert all the time, it's not good for you. Or it could mean we're eating things like antifreeze or something that's just really terrible for you. So I think cultural gluttony actually has parallels to each one of those things. You could watch spend too much time watching movies and reading books and so on. You could maybe spend maybe have too much emphasis on certain things that are maybe okay in and of themselves, but if your whole life revolves around Lord of the Rings, for example, the movies or something, you know, it's not good for you. And other things that you just shouldn't watch altogether, pornography. Okay. Also, we might get the idea that God doesn't care about our entertainment, or that it somehow exists in a sphere of neutrality to which God is indifferent. And so that attitude, I think, could lead to gluttony. Okay, but in the event, we went around on this a few times, sent emails back and forth, and I agreed to take on cultural anorexia and art and literature. And that's where we're going to start today. But unfortunately for the pastor who's got to speak on music and movies and cultural gluttony, since arts and literature, you know, literature storytelling, movie storytelling, a lot of things I'm going to say are going to apply to movies too, so I don't know if I have anything left to say. Maybe we'll just have an extended game session. This is a difficult subject, okay? We're not just going to sit down and pick up several chapters in the Bible and sort of study them exegetically and, you know, draw the conclusion about which kind of movies it's okay to see and how you decide exactly. We're going to try to work in that direction. But this book by K.L. Billingsley is called The Seductive Image, A Christian Critique of the World of Film. And I like his... he has an introduction at the beginning. Why is he writing this book? And he introduces the topic as a minefield. And I think this is a good illustration of what we're up against. He says, 7 years ago, a director friend suggested that I run, not walk, to see a new British film called Chariots of Fire. I saw the picture at my earliest convenience, liked what I saw, and recommended that my friends give it a try. However, one Christian friend, though intrigued with the story, was not ready to slap on his Nikes and dash to the box office. He first wanted to know whether it was a Christian film. The question surprised me because the fellow watched plenty of primetime television without applying any spiritual test. Neither had this question been raised when he and his wife took us to see My Brilliant Career, an Australian film they adored but which I found boring. I replied that I didn't know whether Chariots of Fire was a Christian film, but that one of its major characters was a committed Christian. I thought this explanation would suffice, but it did not. One Christian character, my friend insisted, did not a Christian film make. As the discussion unfolded, I raised the question whether there was any such thing as a specifically Christian movie. My friend was a still photographer of considerable talent. I asked him if the photos he took of trees and rocks were Christian pictures. If the subject of one of his portraits was a faithful pastor, would this automatically make it a Christian photograph? What if a Zoroastrian priest or atheist had taken the same photograph? Would it still qualify as Christian? Did he perhaps use Christian film for a Christian camera? Or if the picture of the Grand Canyon was technically perfect, would this make it a Christian photograph? Were the photographs of Ansel Adams and Edward Weston, two artists my friend revered, Christian photographs? Conversely, how about a picture of, say, Billy Graham with his face cropped just above the eyebrows? What about an overexposed, out-of-focus shot of Chartres Cathedral with a garbage truck parked in front? Would these poor efforts qualify as Christian pictures, even if a Christian took them? No clear answers to these questions emerged. I then applied this line of reasoning to Chariots of Fire. I didn't know the religious beliefs of those who made the film, but I assumed they were not Christian, since few in the film business are. Nor were all the characters in the story Christian, and no one gets converted. Moreover, it is made clear that the Christian character meets an untimely demise. My photographer friend was still not satisfied, but his sole answer to these arguments was to repeat his original question. I believe at one point I asked if The Ten Commandments was a Jewish film. We eventually called a truce. I relate this at some length to show that any work on a highly subjective topic like cinema is a veritable minefield. The cinema and criticism of it is not science, theology, or an academic discipline, and there is nothing resembling a consensus. Okay, and he goes on to discuss the problem further at length, you know, that if there were a host of biblical teaching on film, say an epistle to Hollywood, that would put an end to much controversy. You know, but with such material lacking, the approach must be of a more general nature. All right. It's a good book. I'd recommend reading it. But it does certainly, if you haven't thought about this, if you haven't run up against this, this can definitely be a problem. As you get out into, say, wider evangelical circles, I think you'll find various sorts of attitudes, a wide range, and some may be pretty close to the friend there. But I'd like to start with several assertions. Okay, first of all, Paul tells us in Ephesians 1, okay, in Ephesians 1, starting with verse 20, I have to interrupt one of Paul's sentences so as to not take too much time, but which he worked in Christ when he raised him from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly places, far above all principality and power and might and dominion, and every name that is named, not only in this age, but also in that which is to come. And he put all things under his feet and gave him to be head over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills all in all. Right, so I'm going to assert that Christ is Lord over all. Okay, he's the head over all things to the church. And therefore, our entertainment is part of all things. And Christ is Lord over it. It's therefore a legitimate field of inquiry for us today at a CUI retreat. Secondly, I plan to show, and I don't have a Bible verse to quote here, but I plan to show the legitimacy of art and literature from the Bible and introduce the idea that man, being made in the image of God, implies, among many other things, it implies the notion of man as a sub-creator. So man, the nature of man, man has creativity and he applies it to create beauty. He may also apply it to create other things, and we'll talk about that. Okay, third, Paul, again in 2 Corinthians 10, see, starting with verse 3, he says, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ, and being ready to punish all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled." Now this is 2 Corinthians 10:5. Right, which has the phrase, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ, is sort of a theme verse for our Bible study. So, I'm going to assert with this verse that there's no neutral ground of entertainment, right, that we can simply take in and not bother evaluating if we are to bring every thought captive to Christ. Okay, so, I guess you could say I'm going to assert it's our obligation to bring every thought captive, and that includes our thinking about entertainment. Okay, well, literature and movies, music, they're all part of the arts, and we could include architecture, poetry, drama, and dance. Right, and as I said, there's no epistle of Paul or any other apostle that gives us exactly what we should do about movies or literature art. So we have to cast a fairly wide net into looking what the Bible has to say with regards to the creative arts. And then we'll take up literature as best we can. So one of the books that I found very helpful is a book by Francis Schaeffer called Art in the Bible. It's a small book. Okay, this is his one volume of his collected works. So Art in the Bible is really just this part. It is a small book. I know some of you are getting a little panicked that I was going to send you home to read it, but another book, let me mention another book here, is called The Christian Imagination. It's by Leland Ryken. It's a collection of essays, but I found particular some essays by Leland Ryken to be particularly useful. So I'll mention all those to you. Okay, well, what does the Bible have to say about art? Not a lot in the way of what we might call didactic teaching, where we're being taught principles, theology. But it refers to art quite a bit. And I'm going to start, maybe not in the beginning, I'm going to start in Exodus 20, in the Ten Commandments. Okay, so we might say, what does the Bible have to say about representational art? "You shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments." Now, if I just read verse 4 by itself, you might get the idea that You know, Christians shouldn't make representational art, art that represents anything. In fact, that's an idea in one popular world religion that we talk about a lot. Does anybody know which one it is? Islam, yeah. So Islam has a ban on representational art. That's why you see things like Persian rugs or that kind of weaving and so on that are things that are very decorative and artistic in a way but don't actually have representations of, say, animals or people on them. Okay, so I think you probably all know this, but right, and if you read verse 5, it sort of gives it away, right, that that's not the end of the discussion. It's really referring to images to be worshipped. And if we look at, that's fairly clear when you read 5, you shall not bow down to them. But if you read Leviticus 26:1, it says, you shall not make idols for yourselves, neither a carved image nor a sacred pillar shall you rear up for yourselves, nor shall you set up an engraved stone in your land to bow down to it, for I am the Lord your God. Okay, and then elsewhere in the Bible, representational art is made. Right? We could we'll come across different things. There's even an example of some representational art that was commanded to be made, and then later people worshipped it and had to be destroyed. But we'll get to that. Okay. Well, a lot of the sort of thinking about this again follows Schaefer, but the building of the tabernacle, which sort of starting, if you turn to Exodus 25, if you look at verses 1 to 9, you'll see large collection of materials that are going to be used. Right, so there are going to be, they're going to use gold, silver, and bronze, blue, purple, and scarlet thread, fine linen and goat's hair, ram skins, dyed red, badger skins, acacia wood, oil for the light, spices for the anointing oil, onyx stones, and so on. It's according to all that I shall show you. So God gave them the pattern. Flipping ahead to verse 17, we have the command there to make the cherubim that sat over the mercy seat. And this is definitely art. This is sculpture. Skip ahead to verse 31. We have instructions for making the lampstands. They're very artistic candlesticks. Go to Exodus 28. We have the priestly garments. Verses 33 and 34. And upon its hem you shall make pomegranates of blue, purple, and scarlet all around its hem, and bells of gold between them all around. Okay, now, I guess I can't say I'm perfectly acquainted with pomegranates in practice, but I don't believe they're all three colors, blue, purple, and scarlet. If somebody knows differently, I guess they could speak up. But turning ahead to Exodus 35 then. And let's see, if we go verses 4 through, say, 36:8, we won't have time to read it all, but again, we have the commands to build things, and let's go ahead to 35:10. All who are gifted artisans among you shall come and make all that the Lord has commanded. There's a presumption there that there are gifted artisans. Okay. Now, we know God's sovereign over all things, so the fact that there's gifted artisans, he's not relying on chance or anything. He's actually an ability he's given these people. All right, so they're designing. Let's see. Sorry, I'm trying to save time by not reading it all. But if you get to verse 30. Say 30 of chapter 35, 30, 31, 32, he's called by name Bezalel, right? And he's filled him with the Spirit of God, wisdom and understanding, in knowledge and in all manner of workmanship to design artistic works, right? And then he was to work in silver and gold and cut jewels and so on. In verse 34, he's put his heart in the ability to teach in him and Aholiab, the son of Ahisamach of the tribe of Dan. Filled him with the skill to do all manner of work of the engraver and the designer and the tapestry maker. Right, so it's emphasized again at the beginning of chapter 36. Right, God gave these Well, I presume they were mostly men, but it doesn't really say, so we can, I guess we could leave that open. Bruce can correct me later. There were women artisans. I don't know. So, anyways, God gave them the gift. They were to make a number of artistic things. A similar thing, similar array of verses could be found in, say, 2 Chronicles describing the temple. You have carvings, sculpted cherubim, pillars that were for beauty only. They had no, if you read the description carefully, they didn't have it, they didn't support anything structural, right? They were just there for beauty. The sea rested on carved oxen. Okay, there were carts with panels showing lions, oxen, and cherubims. Okay, well, maybe then all this art is okay, but it's just for the worship of God. Well, maybe, but if you go to 1 Kings 10, verses 18 and 20, there's at least an account. Now, we always have to be careful with accounts of what happened, right? But because sometimes there's accounts of things that happened are bad, and the Bible doesn't always say, oh, that was sin. You know, sometimes we're left to figure this out for ourselves, or it's assumed that we'll understand that it was sin. So it's not everything that we can find is what we might call an approved example, but here is an example, and at least it's not negatively commented on. Right? That's, moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with pure gold. The throne had six steps, and the top of the throne was round at the back. There were armrests on either side of the place of the seat, and two lions stood beside the armrest. 12 lions stood there, one on each side of the six steps. Nothing like this had been made for any other kingdom. Okay, so there's at least an example of art being used for a non-religious purpose. Jesus used art. He referred to the serpent that Moses lifted up in the wilderness. Right, that bronze serpent was a work of art. I thought I had it in my notes here. Maybe I refer to it again, but anyways, later on, that's let's see. I think it was Hezekiah, wasn't it, that had to destroy the bronze serpent because the people were worshiping it. Okay, well, if we turn to the written word, right, we might think of things like poetry, literature, drama. In the Bible, we'll find plenty of poetry. The Psalms are basically poems. They're intricately crafted poems. Find a secular poem, 2 Samuel 1, verses 17-27 is an ode to Saul and Jonathan. There's drama, Ezekiel 4. You remember Ezekiel did all these things that we might call guerrilla theater today. You know, he laid on one side for a long time. He shaved his head. You know, he did these various sorts of things. Literature. Well, arguably, the Bible is literature, right? Ecclesiastes 12, right, tells us 9 and 10. And moreover, because the preacher is wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find acceptable words, and what was written was upright, words of truth. Okay, and let's see. The ESV translation, instead of what was upright, says the preacher sought to find words of delight. Okay. NASB is also delightful words. So, arguably, much of the Bible is literature, very fine literature. It is not written solely as bare facts, history, and didactic teaching. Right, now, Leland Ryken says that Christians have traditionally found it difficult to grant integrity to this world of the imagination. He's talking about fictional literature. And found ways to suppress or discredit the imaginary element in literature. One tendency has been to denigrate fiction and fantasy as being untruthful, frivolous, a waste of time, escapist, and something to be left behind with childhood. Others have tried to excise the imaginary aspect of literature by acting as though literature is a direct replica of everyday life, ignoring all that is unlifelike about it. The impulse to reduce literature to ideas has also been a perennially popular way for Christians to avoid the imaginary dimension of literature. Ryken goes on to say, these responses misinterpret the nature of literature. Literature is built on a grand paradox. It is a make-believe world that nonetheless reminds us of real life. The 18th century critic Samuel Johnson noted that the imitations of literature are not mistaken for realities, but bring realities to mind. And I think it's Ryken also that says elsewhere, history, biography, etc. describe what happened. Literature describes what happens, right? Offering, as it were, an insight into the human condition. Okay, you probably won't run into people that say refuse to read literature because that's not the truth. But you'll find some say Christian sects that believe that. Ryken goes on to say the example of the Bible, which is central to any attempt to formulate a Christian approach to literature, sanctions the imagination as a valid form of expressing truth. The Bible is in large part a work of imagination. Its most customary way of expressing truth is not the sermon or theological outline, but the story, the poem, and the vision. All of them literary forms and products of the imagination, though not necessarily the fictional imagination. So be careful. When I say it's a work of the imagination, I'm not saying it's untrue. I'm saying it's presented, though, in an imagination, creativity were used to present what's in the Bible. I mean, just look at the book of Revelation. Right? Full of symbols. It's a highly literary book. Okay, well, what might we make of all this art, literature, drama, poetry, etc. in the Bible? Okay, well, first of all, I guess you could say it's an assertion on my part, although much of it is incorporated in the tabernacle and temple, it's not all part of Old Testament worship. It is part of life. Right? And abilities in the arts are gifts of God. Right? The art is both representational and non-representational. Okay, neither kind is to be worshipped. And I guess here's where I have my reference about the bronze serpent being destroyed by Hezekiah. People worshipped it and called it Nehushtan. Yeah, they turned it into an idol. Schaefer says Christian art is by no means always religious art. That is art which deals with religious themes. Right? God's creation did not just deal with religious subjects. And the Bible contains plenty of non-religious material. God is Lord of all, so all things fall under His jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. Also, art's not necessarily to be photographic. I'll use photographic in quotes, but I mean it's not all to be exactly lifelike, right? It's not just we don't just have art because people didn't have cameras, and we don't write fiction just because we don't know exactly what happened, so we'll make something up. Although that happens too. Okay. But the fact that it's not all to be photographic, right, so you can think of the blue, purple, and scarlet pomegranates, is a way to lead to the idea that art is creative. Okay, this may seem obvious, but I have definitely heard Christians reject art because it's not realistic, right? They want art that is just looks like, you know, pretty close to a photograph, then it's good. The closer to a photograph, the better. Well, and likewise for literature, people sometimes reject things because, you know, it's not realistic. What I'm about to argue, though, is that being creative is part of what it means to be made in the image of God. If we turn back to Genesis 1, 26 and 27. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in His own image. In the image of God, He created them. Male and female, He created them. Now, there's a lot that could be said about being created in the image of God. Okay, so I'm only going to deal with one aspect. And I'm going to quote Francis Schaeffer. I think he puts it well. "An artwork has value as a creation because man is made in the image of God. And therefore, man can not only love and think and feel emotion, but also has the capacity to create. Being in the image of the Creator, we are called upon to have creativity. In fact, it is part of the image of God to be creative or to have creativity. We never find an animal, non-man, making a work of art. On the other hand, we never find men anywhere in the world or in any culture in the world who do not produce art. Creativity is part of the distinction between man and non-man. All people are to some degree creative. Creativity is intrinsic to our mannishness. But we must be careful not to reverse this. Not everything that man makes is good, intellectually or morally. So while creativity is a good thing in itself, it does not mean that everything that comes out of man's creativity is good. For while man was made in the image of God, he is fallen. Furthermore, since men have various gifts and talents, everyone cannot create everything equally well. However, the main point is that creativity as creativity is a good thing as such." And speaking of creation, if we skip forward another chapter to Genesis 2, 9, and 10, right? It says the Lord God planted a garden eastward at Eden. There he put the man whom he had formed. And out of the ground the Lord God made every tree grow that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. Okay, God's creation was not just utilitarian. It wasn't just to provide food, which we need to eat to live, right? The garden wasn't just designed so that man could survive, right? It says right there, he made every tree grow that is pleasant to the sight, right? And I'd say all we have to do is, you know, drive around maybe some parts of Oklahoma, maybe it's easier in Colorado to see the beauty of creation. So we're certainly not going to have time to fully explore this concept of man being a sub-creator or man as a sub-creator of beauty, right? But being in the image of the Creator is partly to be creative ourselves and to create beauty, right? And it's something you can think about. Okay. Well, there in the current art world, there's all kinds of things that go on, and certainly I'm no expert on the fine arts, right? Schaeffer was concerned that the art world of the 60s, when he was writing, or 60s, early 70s, right, that the art had been turned into a... what does he say? He says they've forgotten the value that art had in itself. Much modern art is far too intellectual to be great art. And many modern artists don't see value in a work of art as a work of art. But Schaeffer says, I'm afraid, however, as evangelicals, we have largely made the same mistake. Too often we think that a work of art has value only if we reduce it to a tract. This, too, is to view art solely as a message for the intellect. Okay, and Schaeffer points out there's three ways we can view art. We can view it as something that's just there and cannot be analyzed, right? So that would go along with this idea that art, literature, and so on are just neutral and, you know, we can read or view art or whatever. Right, so the second one is that it's a message, right? So in that case, we write our fiction or we make our art only to carry a specific message, right? So, but that really sort of devalues the work of art as a work of art, and you end up with propaganda. Right, or finally, the third view is that the artist makes a work of art, and that the body of his work shows his worldview. Right, it comes out; it's expressed inevitably through the art. That's the view that I will promulgate and promulgating. Okay, so far we've discussed art in the Bible and in life, and how creativity is part of man's God-given nature. Right, how God created the garden not just so it gave food, but so that it was pleasing to the sight. Right, and we've asserted that the artist or author's worldview will come out in their work. But I would also like to tell you that because men are sinners and can deceive themselves, because they're sinners, their worldview may be evil. Because they can deceive themselves, the way their worldview comes out in their work may be dishonest. Okay, and Schaeffer made the point that the greater the work of art, the higher the quality, the better the artist, the stronger the effect of the worldview, the promotion of the worldview. So, off to summarize some. If you think back to 2 Samuel 12, you maybe remember that David had lusted after Bathsheba and had killed her husband and thought he'd gotten away with it maybe, right? Nathan confronted him and gave him the story about the poor man who had only one lamb and how the lamb was stolen, right? And if I remember right, I think David said the man must die, and Nathan told him, you are the man. Right, that is an example of a story, right, being used, drama, literature being used to make a point more clearly than it could be made, probably than if Nathan had just marched in and said, this is what you did and it was wrong, you know. So, Another way of looking at this is to say we're more susceptible to lies when they are told in a pleasing fashion. Right? So a great artist or author's worldview may slip through to us, right? And we may sort of imbibe it and take it in if we're not careful to consider just what is being communicated. Okay, if we're to bring every thought into captivity, then it's important that we do not uncritically consume art, literature, or music and movies. Rather, it's important that we judge what we are consuming. So, maybe I'm going to start to overlap with Bruce so I can go quickly, but I was going to at least cover briefly judging, since I'm promoting the arts and literature, well, how should we judge what we view? So, Schaeffer suggested four things: technical excellence, validity, intellectual content, the worldview which comes through, and the integration of content and vehicle. So, with regard to technical excellence, right, it's an aspect of art. It's an aspect of literature, one that we can approve of. Right now, it may be that we may say such and such an artist's worldview, or that we don't agree with it, but the person is nonetheless a great artist. Right? In terms of validity, is the artist honest to himself and to his worldview? Or is he making his art only for the money or for the sake of being accepted? Right? My own take on this is literature, with respect to literature, is it written mainly with an eye to maximize the number of copies sold? Or perhaps in a movie, is the plot scripted to please a certain audience? Right, so gratuitous sex in movies is one example. Right, it's often placed in there just to try to make more money. There have been some really dumb examples. A Tom Clancy movie that was about Islamic terrorists blowing up Denver, actually, with a nuclear bomb, The Sum of All Fears. In the movie, it was changed to neo-Nazis because the movie makers were either politically correct or just didn't want to get killed, one or the other. Okay. Another aspect that I'd like to bring out is the question, is the author honest in his treatment of sin and its consequences? Okay, an author may depict sin that we would rightly reject. I mean, not the sin. Well, we might reject the depiction, too, depending how it's done. But, or you know, he might reject sin. It might be in a form we don't want to hear about. But question, does the author depict the consequences? Right? So it's possible for a non-Christian to portray sin and also portray the devastating consequences. Okay, so because an author can be dishonest about his worldview or about the impacts doesn't mean that he necessarily will be. An example that comes to my mind is the novella by Norman MacLean called A River Runs Through It. It was made into a movie about 12, 13 years ago, something like that. In it, you know, there's two brothers, and one brother becomes an English professor. He's the one who writes the book. The other brother becomes a journalist. They both have similar talents, but the brother that becomes a journalist is a hard-drinking, womanizing, gambling young man. And what you see in the novel, the novella, is you see his life basically slowly coming apart. He's finally killed by somebody who he owed money to. He'd run up his gambling debts too high. And it's a case, to my way of thinking, it's an example of a case where you might say, well, you know, he's portraying all this womanizing and drinking and so on. But in fact, he's not glorifying it. In fact, he shows the actual consequences of it. And I don't have any reason to think Norman MacLean is necessarily an evangelical Christian or anything, but I just think it was sort of an honest portrayal. Okay, content. So Schaeffer says, here we can judge the content independent of the technical excellence. Right? We might say that it's a great book, but the author's worldview is wrong. Right? We can sometimes, I think, we can appreciate art and appreciate literature that we don't agree with. Or, as is often the case, there might be parts that we could say, well, this part was good. It showed these character traits as being good. And on the other hand, it showed these things as going on and nothing ever happened. There was no consequence for the sin. And I think you're going to find a lot of modern literature and movies fall into that standpoint, into that category of sort of being a mixed message. That would be the ones that aren't all bad. So, Yes, and just as another reminder, Schaefer said, we should realize that if something untrue or immoral is stated in great art, it can be far more destructive and devastating than if it is expressed in poor art or prosaic statement. Okay, and he mentions that a lot of crude art is so poor, even though it has destructive messages, it's so poor that it doesn't have much force. But the greater the artistic expression, the more important it is to consciously bring it and its worldview under the judgment of Christ in the Bible. Okay, the fourth criteria is how well does the art form fit the message? And I'm going to completely skip over that. But certainly with art and music and movies, there are forms that fit a message, fit what's being said better than, some ways better than others. So, yes. So you could take a sort of very modern cinematic style, and which shows a lot of the things out of order and all chopped up if you're trying to tell some story, and the form could ruin the expression. Okay, so to conclude, art, literature, and I'll go so far as to say movies and music are also our gifts of God. There's little didactic teaching in the Bible on art, but plenty of examples. God is a creator of beauty, and we are sub-creators. Creativity is part of what makes man, man. Art, literature, movies, and music aren't inherently sinful. They're inherently a blessing. I think they are. But they can be abused and misused. And they can certainly be, this can be intentional or unintentional on the artist's part. Right? It can be because it accurately reflects the author's or artist's fallacious worldview, or because it dishonestly reflects their worldview. Because of this, and because great art and great literature can create an especially attractive environment for communicating lies, we need to be discerning and judge our entertainment if we are to bring every thought captive. So, thank you. Are you wanting to get the questions and answers on here? Oh, we can leave them on and you can cut them off later. Bruce offered the use of cards. I'm willing to take questions, comments, sort of either way. So, in fact, if you still have the cards?
I passed them out already.
You passed them out. Okay, so if you'd like a card, and if you'd prefer to write down a question, some of you might rather do that, or some of you might rather just blurt it out, or some of you might rather just sit and be silent and hope somebody else asks a question.
Any cards to hand in?
Well, we don't know yet. They may all just sit on their hands. Okay, well, are there any other questions then of the non-handed in variety?
When you were talking about these forms of art, you know, I'm still stuck with my kids at home. And maybe it's off the topic. I think the point is very helpful. But how would you fit, you know, one of these small children sitting down and drawing a picture of the cat into this view of art? And were you saying that this art showing a world view is part of every artistic expression?
So let me see if I can address the two questions. The first one is asks about children, and you know, that say sit down, if a 3-year-old sits down and draws a picture of a cat, or a 7-year-old or a 10-year-old or whatever. Okay. And I would say yes, that's part of their nature being created in the image of God, right? Something they children naturally do. Right? You didn't have to sit down and teach the child. Well, you might have, but you don't necessarily have to sit down and teach a child how to draw a cat. Now, they might not be very good at it, right? And if I sit down and draw a picture of a cat, you might say, well, that's not very good. I would fit in the category then of, you know, somebody who, you know, Schaefer said, the greater the artistic expression, the more important it is to consciously bring it and its worldview under the judgment of Christ in the Bible. Well, I'd fit more like the lesser the artistic expression is, the lesser it would fit. Right, and so I think that children drawing is just part of the human creativity. So, I guess, would you like?
Is their worldview being expressed through that?
Well, probably. Their worldview is that the cat's there, the cat's real, and I'm going to draw a picture of it. Now, this is the next question. Does every piece of art reflect the worldview? It's a good question. Right, and I think that's one of the challenges we face, because it's easy to say that art reflects a worldview. It's not also always easy to reflect, to understand what the worldview is. And I'll say, especially as we get to things like, say visual art is maybe harder for us to understand. Maybe with literature it's a little bit easier because it's more propositional in nature. There's you can look at what do the characters do and what do they say and what happens, right? So I would say it all reflects a worldview. I think particularly with visual arts, Schaefer makes the point that it's often the body of an artist's work. It's not just one piece that reflects it. But I think other than that, I'd probably leave that question to sort of another time. If you read, Schaefer has several works that you art in the Bible, but also how then should we live, or how should we then live, or how we should then, well, however it goes. Yeah. However it goes, he's got some books where he discusses some of those things. So, okay. Another question?
Yeah. Ephesians 5:3-4. I'll go ahead and read it. Fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not even be named among you. The NIV says, let there be not even a hint. Neither filthiness nor foolish talking and coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks. So the question is, when we're picking what kinds of things we watch or songs we listen to, things we put into our brain, what kind of standard?
Where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah.
I hope that the pastor is going to cover that this evening. That was really how we sort of split it up.
Okay.
I will just observe from the cultural anorexia standpoint, right? You could take that verse and say, well, I shouldn't put anything that has, say, adultery in it, in my mind. And there's a lot of things that, refer to adultery that you shouldn't put in your mind. A lot of them, there's a lot of movies that have graphic depictions, right? But in fact, the Bible depicts adultery, right? We already referred to one instance of it, right, with Bathsheba. The Bible, talks about murder, talks about it sometimes in graphic detail. Was it Abner that sliced open, or was it Abner? I can't remember, but if you go back, there's, descriptions of assassination, including, sticking the knife blade up to the hilt and, cutting through the fat and the guts falling out, and then leaving while the servants think the guy's in the bathroom. There's graphic depictions in the Bible, so you can definitely go the other direction. I'm trying to take the first view, so the first aspect. I do think you have to be careful, and I also think you have to be very careful to analyze what it is you're viewing. And often, it is true that the things, say there's a movie that has, graphic sex scenes in it. Well, I could tell you, I'll tell you right now, I'll steal Bruce's thunder, don't go see the movie, okay? So, there's things like that that are maybe pretty obvious. You could say, well, no, I really shouldn't be looking at that. Right? But there's also a lot of things that aren't going to be like that. Things, say, that appear on primetime TV, and maybe they don't have, graphic images, but they portray a lie. And I think almost, I don't want to say you should be more careful about that, because I don't want to imply that you don't need to be careful about the, pornography or something. You should be careful about that too. But I think you, in a sense, you have to be just as much on your guard for things that are not graphic, that are not obvious, because they portray a worldview. Right? A lot of popular music, a lot of rock music, that isn't obscene or, it has no vulgarities or obscenities, profanity in it. A lot of it will still portray the message that the main thing about life, the main way that you could be satisfied as a human being, is through love or sex, but maybe just love. I think a lot of pop music, right? Right, and I think as a Christian, now I wouldn't say therefore you should not listen to any pop music. No, that's not what I would say. And if you saw my CD collection, you would know that that's not the case. But I would say, if we're going to bring every thought captive, is we have to think about, analyze, well, what do these words mean? Right? You know, and maybe there's some sentiment in here. I mean, you know, love within marriage is a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful blessing. Right? But it's not everything to life, right? It's not all that great apart from Christ, right? I mean, it doesn't save you, right? And a lot of pop music will give you the message that, you know, you're saved through love. You know, if you just find that right person, that, you know, your life's going to be great. You know, and well, as Dr. Fisher says, quoting somebody, marriage is given for our sanctification. Okay. So, and a lot of pop music says, in a sense, love is given for our justification or something like that. All right. So, I think, again, Bruce will talk more about this, but I may have covered a number of things he's going to talk about, but I guess what I'm saying is there are a lot of things that on the surface you would not reject as sort of, you know, impossible for a Christian to watch, and yet you should be very careful. And I'm not saying very careful, so you shouldn't necessarily watch it or read it, but very careful in how you think about it, and that you don't sort of drink in the ethos of what's being taught. Mr. Yost?
Just to comment on that a little bit, the Stillwater CY are considering a series of articles talking about the similar topic. I don't want to encroach too much on Bruce's topic as well, but with this notion of keeping our eyes pure, taking every thought captive to Christ, and such, we've been trying to think about how to balance that with Paul, for example, in his trip through Athens, with rank idolatry everywhere. The city was filled with idols. I don't know it real well, but I think there was probably a lot of graphic stuff, and there was probably somebody probably used really bad language, or some of them did. And I'm thinking about Jesus and his tendency to hang out with these people that really made the Pharisees angry, because he kept hanging out with all these dirty people, and yet they used those opportunities. Somehow they were able to keep their minds pure, especially Christ, but were able to use it as a vehicle to engage this this blasphemy that was going on. Paul saying, well, you have this idol here to an unknown God. And we talked at CY about how we probably wouldn't have thought this. We probably would have just said, this is crap. I'm not going to behold all this in this form. No. He said, who do you think about that unknown God? I know about him. And he actually creates everything. And he uses it as a platform then. He gets their attention. And so there's some sort of balance there.
Yeah.
I think it's probably...
Yeah, that's a very good point. I did not really bring up. I guess I partly, you know, maybe my sense. I don't know everyone from the presbytery, so maybe my sense might be wrong. But within our own CY, I don't sense the temptation to abstain from all movies and literature and so on. Right. But I mean, if you do abstain from all movies and literature and so on, yes, you can definitely end up being irrelevant. You know, that's, and you may have a hard time understanding the culture. You sort of withdraw. So, I mean, that would be a downside to really being cultural anorexic. But, yeah, no, that's good.
I think anybody else's time. Could you elaborate on, does a work of art have to have Jesus as a subject to be Christian? You said what might be bad, but
okay.
And how those are portrayed. What was worldviews, or how can an artist, Christian artist, portray truth?
Yeah, well, I think that's a good question. It sort of goes back to the introduction of the Billingsley book, where he talked about all the problems with what is Christian art. And no, I don't think art has to portray Jesus to be Christian. So, in fact, we might have another problem with that, right? Falling into the category of something that people might be tempted to worship. But I think I think a Christian artist, first of all, lets their worldview come through. So I think one thing that often will come out in a Christian work is redemption. Now, it may not be, and it likely will not be, oh, this person, you know, accepted Jesus, you know, and so on, a conversion story at the end, right? But there will be, I think, often a sense, I mean, in terms of the world, of the Christian worldview, that there is such a thing as sin, right? And it has consequences. There's such a thing as beauty, goodness, such a thing as right and wrong. There's a lot of like postmodern movies and novel things where, you know, like the robbers are the good guys and stuff like that. And I think that's sort of a non-Christian, you know, reflects a non-Christian worldview. So, it's very hard to say this is a Christian movie. I mean, I think you could almost say, in a sense, it's an impossible question to answer authoritatively about a specific piece of work. You could say, well, it's written by a Christian, it reflects the Christian worldview in these ways. Even then, there might be something, but look at this sort of subplot here. This is wrong. You know, there's a, you know, so that very much might be the case. Now, Schaefer had what he called a major view and a minor, or major theme and a minor theme. So his minor theme was what he called the abnormality of the revolting world. Right? So men who have revolted from God and not come back to Christ are eternally lost. They see their meaninglessness in the present, and in this they are right from their own standpoint. Okay, so. So that's part of this minor theme on the abnormality, right? And so people may actually see their lostness. And this could be written by unbelievers, definitely. So if you listen to the... none of you will have ever listened to this album by this band called Pink Floyd, called The Wall. But, you know, in it, the main character, whose name is Pink, you know, the guy's just utterly lost. Right? And it's just... You know, it ends with him being eaten by facing final judgment, being eaten by the worms. You know, just completely despairs of life. Right? And in this, they are right from their own standpoint. Right? So, and also for Christians, there's a defeated and sinful side of our lives. Right? If we're all honest, we have to admit that we don't always have, we're not always totally living totally victoriously. Right? We struggle with sin. Right? So he calls that the minor theme, and then the major theme is actually the meaningfulness and purposefulness of life, and you know, viewed from a Christian perspective. So I don't think I can answer your question in a real definitive way, but maybe that'll shed a little more light on it. So, okay. Anything else, or off to the next thing? Okay, well, thank you very much for your time.